Was justice served in one of Evansville's most infamous murders? I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, author Daniel Melchior takes a deep dive into the 1963 drowning death of funeral home director Rudy Zeemer, a known homosexual. Despite witnesses, hard evidence, and even a confession, three former Fort Campbell soldiers are found not guilty. The book, The Silk Finisher, takes the reader back to a divided community and looks at the attitudes that led to the verdict. Do stains and stubborn wrinkles remain decades later? We hear from author Daniel Melchior next on 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger Kimrin and the Berger Wealth Team at Bayard Private Wealth Management. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, and this show involves one of the most controversial trials and verdicts in local history. A well-known homosexual business owner is killed, and despite a confession from one of the defendants, a jury finds the three men accused of his murder not guilty. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. More than 50 years ago, as I slept in my childhood home on Marshall Avenue, just a block away, a man struggled to escape his car after being beaten and robbed. He didn't get away, and the Dodge station wagon ended up in the backwaters of the Ohio River. 2 days later, divers recovered the submerged station wagon with a body inside. Funeral director Rudolph Rudy Zeemer drowned, but investigators determined it was no accident. He was murdered. The death of Rudy Zeemer remains to this day one of the most infamous true crime stories in Evansville history. So let's go back to March 12, 1963, a Tuesday night, a school night for me and my siblings. I was a freshman at Bossy High School, a full house at our home on the 1800 block of Marshall Avenue. My parents and five children. Our house was next door to the Colonial Manor Apartments off Lodge Avenue. There was a dead end on Marshall Avenue that became a crime scene. Apparently, the entire neighborhood slept through the final hour of Rudy Zeemer's life. Author Kelly Coors includes the Zeemer case in his book, Out in Evansville, A Gay History of the City. The book details Zeemer's past history as a known homosexual, the investigation into his death, and the trial where a jury found three former Fort Campbell soldiers not guilty of murdering Zeemer, who was described by the defense as a sexual pervert. A newly released book takes an even deeper dive into the Rudy Zeemer story, described as a true crime memoir where there's bigotry, murder, and sacrifice in the crossroads of America. The book is titled The Silk Finisher, as the author seeks to iron some wrinkles in his own family history and presses us to face our own fears and biases. The author of The Silk Finisher is Daniel Melchior, an Evansville native now living in San Diego. So, Daniel, welcome to 2 Main Street, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
The true crime story really hit close to my home because it was just right down the street and really in my own backyard. And you lived in that area, too? Grew up in that area?
I did. I grew up on the southeast side of Evansville. Now, this happened before I was born, but my family was friends with Rudy Zeemer, so I've known of the story. And then my uncle and I were having beers one night in Charlotte, North Carolina. He told me a little bit more about it, and it really started to fascinate me, and I wanted to start researching it.
And kind of the theme of your book, because you bring your family history into this book as well, the parallels of the past and present, tell me about that.
Yeah, well, if you look at it, in Rudy's case, this was during the civil rights era, and there were a lot of really things going on with just the civil rights era, with African Americans, with the gay community. We're seeing the same things today, particularly in the last like 10, 12 years. So I feel there's a parallel. It's a little bit of history repeating. And so when I started looking at this story, I thought the culture relevancy was really pretty outstanding for where we are today.
Mm-hmm. So are we moving forward? You are about the same.
Yeah, I think it's about the same, to be honest with you. I think we move forward a little bit, and then we take a few steps back. So it always seems like it goes that way.
The title is interesting, The Silk Finisher. Who and what is a silk finisher?
Yeah. So a silk finisher is someone who works in a dry cleaning industry. They press clothes. So, you know, you can press trousers and suits and things like that. But a silk finisher is one who presses the really delicate garments, wedding gowns, things like that. Because one thing you can do, my grandpa owned a dry cleaners, and I can tell you one thing you can do, you can take a really fine piece of silk and ruin it pretty quickly if you don't know what you're doing, because you can burn it with the steam that takes the wrinkles out. So it's a delicate balance. And my mom was a silk finisher. She pressed clothes for 40 years and probably pressed clothes at a Michael Jordan type level. She was really, really good at it.
So people had the fine fabrics would go to the rainbow cleaners?
They would go to rainbow cleaners. That's where my mom learned it. That was my grandpa George, my paternal grandpa. That was his dry cleaners, and my mom went to work there after she married my dad.
Your mom's first name?
Dolores. Dolores with an O, D-O-L-O-R-E-S.
Okay. All right. Okay, let's go back to the Rudy Zeemer case. Who was Rudy Zeemer?
So Rudy Zeemer actually founded Zeemer Funeral Home in 1927. He was literally only 21 years old when he did that. And I think it might have been because his dad died when he was 17. He went away for a little bit, came back, graduated from Memorial, and then he went up to the C.G. Askin School of Embalming, which was part of the Indiana University School of Medicine, graduated, came back home, and started Zeemer Funeral Home.
And I understand he was very successful.
He was very successful. His brother, Ted, joined him it was 2 or 3 years later. He also went to the C.G. Askin School, and then Ted came back, and they, as two brothers, built a very, very successful business.
Now, this is the former home of Mayor Bossie?
Yes, exactly. So the site today on First Avenue, that used to be where the Benjamin Bossie home was. They renovated that home. They originally started in a smaller place, and then I think it was 1938 or so when they renovated Benjamin Bossie's home and made it into really one of the finest funeral homes, not only in the tri-state, but probably in Indiana as a whole.
And I understand that Rudy and his brother, Ted?
Yes.
Somehow, they didn't get along sometimes, did they?
Yeah, and, you know, Ted was, according to everything I researched, Ted was more of the quiet type, and Rudy was a man about town. And, you know, he even had a car crash, I think, before the 1939 regatta, where they raced speedboats up and down the Ohio River. He got into a really vicious car crash, and that was kind of the beginning of Rudy Zeemer being known as a bit of a notorious character in Evansville.
Very flamboyant. He liked flashy cars and flashy clothing, too, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He bought a lot of suits from Strauss Brothers. That's where my great-uncle worked, and he sold a lot of those suits to Rudy Zeemer. He always dressed very well when he was, you know, greeting mourners and things like that. So, yeah, he looked the part. He looked the part of a successful businessman.
Right. So he was 56 years old when this crime happened, and he ends up at the Old Kentucky Barbecue. Is that off of Old Highway 41?
Yeah, it's Old Highway 41, Kentucky Avenue right there. The building is still there. It's a car lot today, but the actual building is still there. They've since repainted it. Kind of looks, you know, a little interesting, but yes, that's exactly where it's at.
Mm-hmm. And that was a kind of a familiar haunt. Folks went there and had their meals and probably a very active bar scene, too. Rudy was probably a known customer.
Yes, he was. As a matter of fact, the bartender that served him that night didn't serve him alcohol, served him a glass of water because Rudy had had a few drinks somewhere else. And so that bartender knew him by name, knew who he was, knew him really well.
And these three paratroopers from Fort Campbell were up on, had leave, and they came up to Evansville to do some partying. They knew some girls up here as well.
Yep.
They show up at Old Kentucky Barbecue, and they were kind of boisterous, weren't they, when they came into the bar?
Yeah, they were boisterous. There was a lot of singing going on. And as a matter of fact, the bartender that didn't serve Zeemer also said that he wasn't going to serve them anymore because they were making a bit of a ruckus and singing and stuff. And it was bothering some of the patrons who were there to eat with their families. And so they left, and then that's when they met Rudy in the parking lot.
So how does Rudy's car end up in my childhood neighborhood on Marshall Avenue.
Yeah, so it was interesting. Rudy left a little bit before they did, and he was in the parking lot struggling with his car. He was inebriated, and they came out and they saw him and literally tried to help him, is the story. They wanted to help him get home. He was too drunk to drive. But there was testimony later that they were actually really trying to rob him. And what they did was they put Rudy into the middle of the car, and then a gentleman by the name of Patrick Perry was driving, and Bill Thompson was on the other side. So they were both on the front seat of the car, and then Rudy was in the middle. And they drove out of the old Kentucky parking lot, and their girlfriends followed them in another car. And then when they got over to that area you're talking about around Marshall Avenue, Rudy apparently made a pass at both of them, and then that's when Patrick Peary hit him, and then William Thompson really beat him and beat him unconscious, and then they took his wallet and left.
Mm-hmm. And that's when they ended up on the levee, over the levee.
Yeah, they left, and they left Rudy there in the car. But what was interesting, when they were driving away, the two girlfriends were from Evansville. They were going through his wallet, and someone said, hey, his name is Rudy Ziemer, and one of the girls recognized the name and said, oh no, this guy's famous here, we have to go back. And so they went back to the car, because they had left Rudy sitting in the middle of Marshall Avenue. They went back to the car, and that's when they started driving him around and ended up at the levee off of Weinbach.
Wow. Okay. Now, the car... is it pushed into the water, backwaters?
No, it was actually driven. So a woman named Carol Sue Gentry actually led them to the levee. And then Bill Thompson drove behind her. They both cars got on top of the levee. And then William Thompson drove Rudy's car to the edge of the water. And then he got out and he actually garroted Rudy's necktie around his neck, and he could hear him breathing. And then he got back in the car, drove it into where it was about waist deep, and then left the car there, shut the door and left the car. And then the car started taking on water and then ultimately floated away probably 100 feet or so into 6 to 8 feet of water, disappeared. And that was the end of it.
And you describe Rudy's last moments, how he must have felt in the car as it was taking on water. It's powerful stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And that's how I start the book. I thought that's really how it needed to start, with, you know, really what he went through in that car ride and then ultimately with his car going into the water.
The car is found, what, 2 days later?
2 days later, they found the car. And it was the way they found the car was three boys were walking along the levee and they found Rudy's personal papers. They found his wallet and his papers, like, just, you know, kind of spread about on the ground. And they, or their parents, immediately called police. And then police went, verified it was Rudy's stuff. And then that's when they sent a team out to the levee to start looking for the car. They couldn't find it immediately. But then someone saw a radial antenna sticking out of the water, and then that's when they were pretty sure that's where his car was.
Mm-hmm. He was taken to the medical examiner, the coroner, and they determined that he died by drowning.
Yes, yes.
But they noticed the bruises on his body, too.
They did. They noticed the bruises. He had bruises around his neck. He had bruises around his eyes and his face where he had been beaten. His glasses were broken. So they knew he had been beaten. And then his tie was really, really tight around his neck. So initially, they weren't sure if he had suffocated from the tie or he had drowned. And then when they did the autopsy, they realized that he had actually drowned.
So it became clear this wasn't just an accident.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so start the investigation and trying to, I guess, follow his path that night before and ended up at the old Kentucky barbecue, and their investigation led to these soldiers at Fort Campbell.
Yep.
And the cops go down to Fort Campbell?
That's right. They went down to Fort Campbell because a waitress in the old Kentucky actually witnessed Rudy get in the car with them. And some of the paratroopers, the old Kentucky was known as a haunt for paratroopers. So a lot of those guys were known. It's not like they had never been there before. So they knew who they were, and they went down there and pretty quickly realized who it was. They knew it was Bill Thompson, a guy named Patrick Peary, and a gentleman named Robert Graymont.
And Thompson actually confessed.
He did. He confessed. He signed a written confession that he did it. He said he could hear Rudy breathing when he put the car into the water, and he admitted driving the car into the water.
So they've got these three guys, and they're allowing them to go out on bail.
Yeah, that was amazing. So they were in jail for a few months. This was in March, and then I believe it was July the 3rd that they actually all three got out on $10,000 bail. Bill Thompson went back to northern Indiana. He was from Gary. And then Pat Peary went back to California. And then Bob Graymont was from Needham, Massachusetts. So they basically went back to their hometowns and waited for the trial to you know, come about.
So the trial finally happens. A change of venue to Warrick County?
Yeah, they moved it up to Boonville. Yeah, they really, their attorneys were pretty successful in arguing that he couldn't get that the three couldn't get a fair trial here. There was just a lot of media here at the time. The story was all over the papers. Didn't think they could get a fair trial, and they wanted it moved to Boonville.
But you'd think it'd be farther away than Boonville.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is in the Evansville media market.
Yeah, you and I know it's the same thing, right? It's
right.
Really not that far away, right?
So they didn't go that far away.
Yeah, exactly.
But they had a large jury pool.
Yes.
And they finally picked a jury. And I understand one of the jurors got in trouble, was facing, contempt of court.
Yes, that was an interesting. He, believe it or not, during the trial, after one of the, you know, kind of long weeks of trial, he decided to go to the old Kentucky barbecue, believe it or not. And Bill Thompson, one of the defendants, happened to be there, and he was there with another witness in the case. And so this James Wathen actually met and talked to Bill Thompson, the defendant, and another of the witnesses. So you can't make this stuff up. I mean, and so it wasn't long. The owner of the old Kentucky kind of said, hey, I know what's going on, and alerted authorities in Boonville that one of the jurors had been there. He got caught pretty quickly, and they kicked him off the case. And, yeah, he got charged with contempt of court.
I understand Judge Beavers wasn't too pleased with this, was he?
No, he was not. He actually was saying, you know, you might cause every jury to be sequestered from now on, and you're wasting taxpayer money because
sure.
It could be a mistrial. So, yeah, Judge Beavers was not very happy with him.
My guest is Evansville native Daniel Melchior. His book, The Silk Finisher, takes the reader to Evansville in the 1960s, the death of Rudy Zeamer, a well-known homosexual, and the trial that ended with a surprising verdict. Now, still to come on 2 Main Street, how my guest weaves his own family history into the narrative and recalls a time when the city witnessed a series of other senseless murders, a family of four slain in their home, and the gunning down of a former mayor. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Evansville native Daniel Melchior, whose new book, The Silk Finisher, looks at how his family and the rest of the community responded to the violent death of funeral director Rudy Zeamer, a well-known homosexual in the community. While many cheered the acquittal of these soldiers for defending themselves against a, quote, sexual pervert, others felt, as Dan Melchior's mom Dolores did, you don't hate anyone no matter what. And there was a divide between the Evans and Melchior sides of the family, wasn't there, Dan?
Yeah, there really was. So my mom's side of the family, the Evans side, you know, they kind of believed Rudy got what he deserved, made a pass at these guys. Hey, that's what happens. You can't do that. My dad's side of the family, they actually knew Rudy. He went to my grandpa's dry cleaners. He bought clothes from my Uncle Bud. They used to hang out with him. They knew Rudy was gay. They didn't care. They liked Rudy. And they felt it was a travesty, one, that he got murdered, and then two, that the, you know, that the three defendants were found not guilty.
Your mom, you write a lot about your mom in the book. She endured a lot.
Yeah.
But kept the family together. Of course, kept a clean house. That was one of her great attributes. She was a good cook and especially a hard worker, wasn't she?
Yeah, she really was an insanely hard worker. It was amazing. Me and my siblings all got the work ethic of my mom. And that's, you know, we're not that smart, we're not that talented, but we work hard, right? So that's kind of what we do. But we really appreciate that she gave us that.
So this was kind of a surprising verdict to many people because it seemed obvious what happened. They killed this guy. And then after the verdict, one juror actually told those defendants to go to church and change their lives.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and I think the defendants, if you read the articles back then, you know, they said they didn't look like killers. You know, they're dressed in suits. They're very well groomed. They took care of themselves. They didn't whisper back and forth to their attorneys. They were really good clients. So they had really good attorneys, and they behaved the way as Burley Scales, one of the prosecutors in the case up in Boonville, he told me that they behaved the way a good defendant will and just listen to your lawyers and don't say anything.
And after all these years, you were actually able to talk to some of the defendants?
Yes, actually. So William Thompson, I was able to get a hold of him. Because it's such a common name, I wanted to really make sure I had the right William Thompson.
Sure.
So it took me about 6 months to find him. And then when I was confident that it was him, I called him one Sunday and I said, you know, I'm looking for William Thompson. And he said, I'm Bill. And I explained what I was doing. And I was a writer and he did not want to talk to me, but I said, hey, you know, you're William Thompson. He said, yes, I am. Why are you doing this? I said, it's an interesting story. I'd like to get your take. And he said, I didn't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. And then I said, okay, I just have one question for you. You are, in fact, the William Thompson I'm looking for, correct? And he said, yes, I am.
Okay.
And then he hung up the phone.
Okay.
But I also talked to Patrick Peary. I got a hold of him, and Patrick Peary actually talked to me twice for about 30 minutes apiece each time. He wouldn't go on the record, but believe it or not, we were going to meet in person for a podcast I did, and then COVID hit, and we weren't able to do it. So I was not able to have any further conversations with him.
Okay, now, also in your book, we kind of talk about other sensational murders that happened in Evansville's history. You mentioned the Mad Dog Killer, Leslie Irwin. This was before the Rudy Zemer case, right?
That's right. That's right. This was in the 50s. And actually, there were, as my mom was turning 21 years old, that's when these crimes were starting to happen. And so as I was kind of piecing together a timeline, I just wanted to look historically what's happening when mom turns 21, what's happening. And then these headlines would come up, oh, Leslie Irwin killed this person, then he killed this person, then he killed others. And so I started to say, hey, wait, there's more of a story here. And then I started to look at the crime rate in Evansville, which is a bit higher than the national average. So when I looked at that, I thought, boy, this kind of weaves into the narrative that we have today of gun violence and things like that, which is, again, part of that history repeating type thing.
Leslie Irwin, actually, he was apprehended and escaped from the Gibson County Jail.
He did. Irvin made a key out of cardboard and some aluminum foil, and he got out and he was on the run. He went all the way from Gibson County and got himself all the way to San Francisco, and he was caught in a jewelry store trying to pawn a ring. And they said the very well-dressed defendant, you know, and he's trying to sell this ring, and the jeweler didn't buy the story that his grandma had given it to him, and he kind of alerted authorities, and they arrested him without incident, and they basically said that Irwin was pretty glad he got caught because he was tired of being on the lam.
And it's ironic, another murder you talked about, Donald Ray Wallace and the Patrick Gilligan family.
Yes.
I think some jewelry he stole from the family, he gave to a girlfriend, that kind of implicated him in that murder as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote about the Gilligan murder is because I remember when that happened and they were trying to find him. And I remember everybody had their lights on. Nobody was going to sleep. We didn't know who this person was, where they were. And so they were scared to death. I remember my sister being scared to death. My mom was scared to death. I just remember the town being really on edge. And I personally remember that. I think I was maybe 11 or 12 years old when that happened. And I never forget the night they caught him.
Well, you probably got that lecture from your parents.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
We all did when things like that would happen.
Yeah, that's right. And we were kind of known here in Evansville for having things like that happen.
Because you had break-ins at Rainbow Cleaners, right?
Yeah, exactly. So my grandpa founded Rainbow in 1947. And that Christmas Eve, the store or the cleaners was broken into. The alarm went off. He goes down there, door smashed in, but they hadn't taken anything. And then the next night on Christmas Day night, the same thing happened. So his cleaners was broken into 2 days in a row. So he was not very happy about that in his first year of business.
Did he get a weapon then?
No, you know, he did not. My grandpa, the only gun we ever had in our house was, or in his house, was an octagon barrel 22 that hung on the wall. And I never saw any bullets to it. And it was just more like an art piece than anything.
Decoration. Okay. Another sensational crime in the city. Of course, the murder of former Mayor Russell Lloyd, shot dead in his home on the east side of Evansville. Julie Van Orden.
Yeah.
Arrested.
That was interesting, too, because my dad, by the time that happened, Rainbow Cleaners had closed, and my mom went to work for Ricochet Cleaners, which is on Fairs Avenue. And my mom didn't drive, so my dad would take her to work every day around 6:30, 6:45. She had to be there by 7, and then my dad would come home. They would drive right by Russell Lloyd's house every single day. And I remember when that happened, and my mom and dad saying, well, we didn't see anything. We drive by there every day, every morning, that time when Julie Van Orden went in there and killed him, and they didn't ever remember seeing anything, because I remember them saying, oh, well, we would have said something had we seen anything, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm. And another one, the unsolved murder of Ray Ryan.
Yeah, that was a wild one. I remember when I was a kid, you know, obviously the explosion, and they blew his car up, and that one's never been solved. I think half of Evansville said they remember hearing the explosion. Mm-hmm. I know I went to McGarry Grade School at the time. We were inside. I don't remember hearing it, but some of my classmates said they heard it. But that was quite a spectacular crime.
I'll tell you my Ray Ryan story. I was at the podiatrist and heard the explosion happen. The podiatrist was like maybe a couple blocks away from the scene. That's the kind of the health spa.
Yeah, the health spa, yeah.
Yeah, he was there. The lights flickered.
Oh, wow.
And I was working at Channel 14 then, and I went, okay, there's something going on. So he patched up my toe. I had an ingrown toenail. He patched up my toe. I hobbled out the door. I had my camera with me, an old Bell & Hal camera with me.
Wow.
Drove over to the health spa, got there, and saw Ryan's body. He was in a Lincoln Continental. The blast blew him out of the car. He was lying on the pavement. Intact. I thought maybe he'd be, you know, mangled or something.
Yeah.
And he had, I remember he had like a kind of striped pants on and everything. And the debris from the car was everywhere. I mean, it blew into the power lines and everything. And it was quite a scene. And I got there right as the fire department was arriving too. Mm-hmm. So great memories of that case. And of course, you said that maybe it was a mob hit.
Yeah, that's what, you know, they had always said, that he had had ties to the mob. And I remember there was a particular mobster, I'm forgetting his name, but he had said that if Ray Ryan didn't do certain things, that even Bobby Kennedy, who was the AG at the time, couldn't protect him because he had testified against the mob a few times.
Okay, and let's learn more about Daniel Melchior, Evansville native, and in the book you write about the many homes you lived in, your dad winning a roll of the dice to get your family into a home on Audubon Drive, a fancy home.
Yeah, it was a fancy home. It was like a split level. It was my mom and dad's first purchase of a house. And as the story goes, at the Colony Cocktail, the guy had, you could give him a quarter and you roll five dice. And if you get five of a kind, you get whatever the, you know, pot was since the last five of a kind. And my dad claims he rolled five of a kind and got $1,500. And he came home, threw the money on the bed and told mom, we're getting a house. And that was the down payment to the house on Audubon.
But didn't stay there that long, did you?
We did not. So we got that house in 65 and then the 72, 73 recession. And the dry cleaners wasn't really doing very well at that time. So Rainbow Dry Cleaners, my grandpa owned it. And my dad and my grandpa both worked there. It wasn't doing enough to support two families. Oh. And so the Rainbow Cleaners kept going. But my dad had to find another job. And he didn't find a job that did well enough to pay for that house. So then we moved into Covert Village, which was Section 8 housing.
Mm-hmm. Now, where'd you go to school?
I started at Plaza, and then in the first grade, in the second grade, I moved to McGarry. And so I went to McGarry Grade School and then on to Harrison High School.
Mm-hmm. And you write in the book, you missed a lot of school.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I hated school. I really did. I hated it. I didn't like it. I wanted to be home. I wanted to be around my mom. I just didn't like school. But then at McGarry, I met a teacher, Frances Hansing, and she actually let us read Edgar Allan Poe's story when I was, in the third grade. I thought that was pretty cool. And she kind of turned me around, and so I didn't quite miss as much school after I met her.
What fascinated you about Poe?
My dad had Edgar Allan Poe books at home, and I just thought in reading them, just the macabre nature of it and kind of always like...
You have a dark side, Daniel.
I think I do, yeah. I think I do a little bit, yeah.
Okay. All right, let's see you. I understand that your family taped Watergate hearings?
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was very strange.
It was very strange. And so they did. They taped them on an audio little cassette recorder back in the day. For whatever reason, they taped those. They did not like Nixon. They were taping them one time. And I remember I was just a little kid, and I asked him if I could say something into the radio or into the microphone. And I said, Richard Nixon's not a nice word.
Okay. And,
my great uncle, my dad and grandpa thought it was really funny, but my grandma and my mom didn't like it so much.
And you went on to college?
I did. I went to, when I first started, it was still ISU.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Harrison High School.
Okay.
Yeah, I went to Harrison and graduated and wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But then I went to ISUE and got a degree in accounting. I did the commuter thing. I stayed and lived with my mom and dad.
The old Centennial School?
Yeah. Well, I mean, ISUE was, part of Indiana State and then became USI. So when I was there, my first report cards came from ISUE, and then it became USI, I think, as my sophomore year.
It wasn't in the old Centennial School? It was in the new building?
Yeah, it was in a new building.
Okay.
Out there. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
Good.
Yep.
All right. So who was Lenora Cupp?
Oh, Lenora Cupp. Yeah, she was our speech teacher at Harrison High School. And I was terrified of public speaking. I was the shyest kid. They were going to send me to a therapist or something. I was so shy. I wouldn't talk to any strangers. So my first class, literally the first class, we had to get up and say our name, grade school, and one thing about ourselves. And I got up and I couldn't say one word. And so I got a 0 on my first ever speech, which was pretty bad. I think she kind of, graded on improvement because I ended up getting a B in the class. But she kind of got me out of my shell a little bit. Uh-huh. So I really appreciated her doing that.
It's funny how we remember certain teachers, don't we?
Yeah.
That,
it's that amazing.
That really change our lives.
It's amazing. Yeah. Uh-huh. She was really something.
So you eventually leave Evansville to seek your fame and fortune. Where did you go?
Yeah, I went to Palm Beach County, Florida. I moved to Lantana, Florida. A buddy of mine from Evansville had gone to Purdue and gotten a job with Motorola down in Palm Beach County, Florida. And I called him up one day and I said, I'm tired of living in Evansville and I want to go to South Florida. And I went to Palm Beach County, Florida.
Mm-hmm. And then from there, where?
Yeah, so I lived there for 3 years and then my dad died young, kind of unexpectedly. I came back here from 92 to 95 and actually got an MBA at USI. And then my brother moved back in town. I wanted to help my mom after my dad died, so I lived back with my mom again while getting my MBA. And then once my brother moved back and things stabilized, then I went back to South Florida again.
Now you live in San Diego now?
I do, yeah. I live in San Diego.
What do you do there?
I work for San Diego State University. I'm an administrator at the university. I try to help the university be more efficient and effective. If you see that, tuition's going up, one of the reasons tuition goes up so high is that higher ed is pretty inefficient. So my career in the corporate world has been making corporations more efficient. That's what I'm trying to do for higher ed. We're the largest, basically, college higher ed system in the country. So if we can make it work at San Diego State, maybe we can make it work for the rest of the country.
So what prompted you to write this book?
Yeah, I had heard this story for a long time, but really, I love the story. I think it's a great story. But again, back there's parallels to today and there's lessons. And my mom being the one who grew up in a bigoted household you know, they taught her to hate and all these things. And I realized my mom taught us better than how than the way she was taught. And so I felt like the lessons that she taught us, it might be nice for others to get those same lessons in a narrative, easy to read form. No opinion, no exposition, just telling stories. And I always kind of had this in my mind that someone should tell my mom's story because, like you said, she's a really hard worker, a really beautiful person, did a lot of great things for a lot of people.
Let's learn more about the Ziemer family. Now, Rudy, he got into the funeral business as a, and into this business as a young man, partnered with his brother. There was this falling out, and Rudy liked flashy cars, boats, clothing, had some DUI arrests and other arrests, so he was known to police.
Yeah, he was. He was very known, and that's the reason that the him and his brother Ted split up. Ted had really seen enough, and I don't blame him. I mean, Rudy was in the paper constantly getting arrested for either DUI. He had multiple sodomy charges against him, although he had never been found guilty of the sodomy charges. But Ted was constantly bailing him out, and I think he had had enough. It was given the funeral home a bad reputation, and so they decided to split off, and Ted founded Ted Ziemer's Fountain Terrace Funeral Home, and then Rudy continued to operate Ziemer Funeral Home.
The trial against these former Fort Campbell soldiers moved to Warwick County. The judge and attorneys there, pretty well known in the community, high-profile case. Like you said, one juror did face contempt of court. Defense called no witnesses. Is that correct?
That is correct. They did not call any witnesses. And basically, they just let what the prosecution had done speak for, you know, their side of the story. And they were very effective in, you know, their cross-examination of smearing Rudy during the cross-examination. And that was really the defense. Let's smear Rudy as we cross-examine. And that's what they did. And really where I learned a lot of this trial was recorded on these little audio recordings. And the court reporter, Sarah Stevens, actually got me these recordings. They were done on these little flimsy discs, not a 33, not a 45, not a 78. So they couldn't understand them. And the player they had was broken. So I put them on a turntable that had a digital input, and I digitized them, and then I slowed them down, and I was able to listen to the trial. Now, in Indiana, you can't broadcast a trial, but I had to get a court order from the judge in Warwick County to allow me to transcribe them, and then I transcribed them for the book and for the podcast as well.
Wow. And it was a quick verdict, wasn't it?
It was very quick. The trial lasted a little over a week, and it was literally about an hour and a half. Hour and a half, they came back not guilty.
Mm-hmm. And what was the initial reaction in the courtroom?
The celebration. Most of the people there that were spectators were in support of the three paratroopers. And so there was celebration. The prosecutor, O.H. Roberts, was extremely upset. He walked out angrily and left. But yeah, there was really a celebration that they had gotten off.
I think one of the defendants, his wife came with their child.
Yeah, that was actually really interesting. So their families were there, and they had their little son, Danny, was there. And what is really interesting is that one of the defendants married one of the prosecution's witnesses. She was one of their, Melvina Schutt was Patrick Peary's girlfriend. Once they got out on bail, Melvina and Pat got married, but Melvina remained a witness for the prosecution. So she was a witness against her own husband. So there was a little conflict of interest there, I have to believe.
Oh, my God. That's a great footnote there. Now, coming up, more of my conversation with author Daniel Melchior, early reviews of the book, The Silk Finisher, what are family members saying about it? Any other books in the works? And have attitudes changed in the 50-plus years since the murder of Rudolph Rudy Ziemer? I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Evansville native Daniel Melchior, author of the newly released true crime memoir, The Silk Finisher, the murder of a homosexual funeral director and the acquittal of three former soldiers in his death. It's also the story of a city dealing with one tragedy after another. There are stubborn wrinkles, but can they be ironed out? That takes us to Rainbow Cleaners and Ricochet Cleaners, ironing and pressing, a family tradition, right?
Yeah, that is. My grandpa founded Rainbow in 1947. My dad worked there when my mom and dad got married. My mom started working there. So pretty much in our family, dry cleaning is what they did for a business, yeah.
Did you ever work there?
I did not work. Well, let's say as a kid, they made me do things every now and again. So my grandpa had actually the last coal-fired boiler for a dry cleaner. And so you had to shovel out the clinker once the coal was burned. So I think I shoveled clinker one time. It took me about 4 hours and I got about $2 for doing it.
It's so, called the clinker?
Clinker. Yeah, it's clinker. So the coal becomes these hard rocks, these kind of big hard rocks, and you got to shovel it out of the thing. And
then that's a dirty job.
It's very dirty. I came out, I was dirty from head to toe. And I didn't make much money for doing it. But then I actually went to work for Ricochet Dry Cleaners. When I went there, my mom worked for Ron Tendel, really great guy. He loved her to death. And when I got 16 and my family was going broke, I needed a job. And my mom said, hey, a delivery driver had quit. And she said, hey, my son just got his license. Maybe he can do it. Now, technically, you can't be a driver for hire at 16. You have to be 18. But Ron was a little loose with things. And he's like, oh, he can do it. He'll be fine. And so I started delivering dry cleaning at 16.
Okay. So why did you weave your family members into this narrative?
Yeah, you know, again, I always wanted to tell my mom's story. And when I really looked at this Rudy Zeamer story and realized how well my family knew him, that became the vehicle to tell my family's story. I really thought they blended together really well. And because Rudy went to the dry cleaners, and dry cleaners, we all wear clothes. We all have to have clothes on. And I used to think about all of the pictures, wedding pictures, graduation pictures, all around Evansville, and think, how many of those clothes did my mom press that are in those pictures, right? Because Ralph Lauren and Vera Wang get a lot of credit for creating these beautiful clothes, but somebody has to clean them and somebody has to press them. And those folks don't ever get the credit. So the silk finisher is a bit of a metaphor for people that do the jobs that no one really notices. And that's really a part of what I wanted to do with this story.
And she was very good at this, wasn't she?
She was very good at it. One, she could do the really basic stuff. I timed her one time because when I was sitting there waiting for the cleaning and going to deliver it, I just kind of timed her. She could do two pair of pants, put them back on the hanger, perfectly pressed in less than a minute. But then sometimes a wedding gown, particularly one that was really complicated, it could take over an hour to press a wedding gown. But she was the best. She knew how to do it. And, you know, they trusted her, especially at Ricochet when she got really, really good. They really trusted her with the really fine garments. If they came in, my mom was the one that was going to press them.
A lot of interesting family characters. Uncle Bill. Tell me about Uncle Bill.
Oh, yeah. Uncle Bill was my mom's brother. He was my mom's younger brother. He was a bit of a hellraiser. He wasn't really raised in the best way. And he actually got in a bit of trouble, and he ended up getting blinded in an accident. He was going to a doctor named Dr. Mullenkamp, who was selling basically prescription pills, uppers and downers, back in the 60s to folks. My uncle went there to get some pills and got hit by a truck crossing the road, and it somehow either severed or just destroyed his optic nerves. So he literally went from being able to see to pitch black for the rest of his life. But he was very good to me. I look a lot like him nowadays. They used to say I was the spitting image of him. So when I'd get in trouble a little bit when I was a kid, I think my mom always was afraid I was going to be like her brother, you know, and so she kept me on the straight and narrow.
And he had a dog named Dolly?
He had a dog named Dolly. Once he got blinded, he actually went up to Michigan, I believe it was Rochester, Michigan, and he got a guide dog named Dolly, and that dog was able to help him walk around. He used to go to Simpson's grocery store. They would help him pick out groceries, but Dolly would get him to the store, and then people would help him pick out groceries. And yeah, Dolly was a great dog for
him. But you were afraid of dogs.
Oh my gosh, I was deathly afraid of dogs, and still, you know, it was bad. Dolly one time chased me out of the backyard. I went jumping over a fence, and they had to carry me back in. I never once petted Dolly. All my cousins loved her to death, but I was scared to death of Dolly.
What triggered that fear?
I don't know. I was afraid of everything when I was a kid. I was afraid of the dark. I was afraid of heights. I was afraid of water. I was afraid of dogs. I don't know where the fear came from, but just I was the youngest in my family, and for whatever reason, I was scared of a lot of things.
Yeah, you have a story about going to swimming lessons.
Yes, yes.
And so, that was terrifying for you.
Very terrifying. Actually, so my mom, when she would just wash my hair or anything, I would freak out. I was scared of water. And then when I was a kid, we had swimming lessons, so I wanted to learn how to swim. But unfortunately, the day of the first time we went in, I went back to class, and about an hour later, my eyes were swelling shut. They were all red. I couldn't see. I guess I was allergic to the chlorine.
Oh, my.
And so they didn't fit me with goggles. They just said, oh, he's not going to learn how to swim. So I didn't learn how to swim as a kid, but luckily I stuck with it. And it only took me until I was 52 to learn how to swim, but I stuck with it.
So you go into the surf in San Diego now?
I do. Yes, okay, I do. Well, I'll go snorkeling and do those things now.
Okay. You write about the deaths of your parents. You also write about your mom going ballistic on your dad. What was that all about?
Oh, yeah, that was an interesting story. So my mom had the steady job at Rick & Jay, but my dad always had ideas of making more money. He was working for an apartment complex. They were going to build a whole bunch of houses, which they were doing, and they needed someone to clean the houses as they were being built and after they got built, and it was going to be double the money. And so my dad convinced my mom to do that. Well, that job only lasted about 2 weeks, and the guy who was building the houses said, hey, I got somebody else in a company that can do it for cheaper. And my mom realized we had just lost a house, and now she lost another job. So she called back Ron Tendle at Rick & Jay Dry Cleaners and begged for her job back. And I think it took Ron less than 30 seconds to give her a job back. And my mom basically told my dad he'd never make another blanking decision in his life.
And I think she got her point across, didn't she?
She did get her point across, and Dad never asked her to do any other job.
So you write a lot about your family in this book. So what's the reaction from your siblings?
Oh, they love it. I mean, they remember a lot of the stories. You know, when I got advanced copies, the first three copies went to my siblings. So my brother Sam's older than me, Amy, and then Andy. So they're all older than me. They all have advanced copies, and they all like it, you know, because they remember the stories as I remember the stories. And they believe, you know, that we really got lucky with my mom. Not everyone in my family had great moms, and we had probably about the best mom. We're all doing really well, and most of it is attributed to her and the lessons that she taught us.
So what's been the reaction, early reaction from to the book?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting. Publishers Weekly, 152 years old, the Bible of the publishing industry, they gave it a review off of an advanced copy, and it was a very, very strong review, said a great affecting account that really hits on a lot of things that are happening today. So the early reviews are really, really sound, and we're very happy with them.
And you think this would be a great movie?
I actually do. I do. I've actually been studying screenplays for a number of years, and I study them out at San Diego State. As I go there, I'm able to take classes, and I've written it as a screenplay, and I particularly believe the Rudy Zehmer story would make one heck of a movie, mm-hmm. No doubt about it.
Any other books in the works?
Yeah, there's a lot of stories that I didn't tell. I used to collect money for a bank down in South Florida, and there's a lot of stories there, and that's a book that I have in mind. But I haven't started working on it, but I really want to do it at some point in time.
How do you think Rudy Zehmer should be remembered? A pervert or a murder victim?
I think a murder victim, you know, I think if you look at the situation of particularly being gay in the 1930s, 40s, 50s in the crossroads of America, that had to be a very difficult life. You really couldn't be openly gay. And I think he probably led a really difficult life. And I think there's got to be some empathy for the life that he had to live. And you know what? He built quite a business, and it's still a successful business today. So a lot of people have flaws, but we got to look at both sides.
Mm-hmm. Society's reaction to the whole LGBT movement, positive?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting. We take two steps forward and some steps back. My brother Andy is gay. That's part of the reason that I wanted to write this. I saw some of the things that he went through in his life. And so, you know, I think it's a kind of a tragedy that, you know, the LGBTQ community particularly has struggled over the last few years and some of the things that have some laws that have been passed and things like that.
In fact, you end the book and you talk about him, and but that's his story to tell.
That's his story to tell. So I didn't tell that story in the book, and that's his story to tell.
So what do you hope readers take away from this book?
I really hope that they take away that, you know, again, there's a little bit of history repeating, but there's some lessons in here. You know, my mom, as you mentioned it early on, you don't hate anyone no matter what. There's a lot of vitriol out there. There's a lot of people, you know, throwing stones at each other, calling each other names. I think we can be bigger than that. I think we can agree that there are things we're going to disagree on, but that's okay. That's part of who we are. But we don't have to vilify the people who don't agree with us. I think we have to find common ground. I'm an absolute believer that common ground leads to higher ground, and you can find common ground with anybody. We all wear clothes, we all eat food, we all sleep, those basic things. So that's why I really like centering this around a dry cleaner, because we all have to wear clothes. Somebody has to press our clothes. You know, that's the common ground.
We all have wrinkles too, don't
yes,
we?
Yes, we all have plenty of wrinkles, and we're getting more of them by the day.
That's right.
At least at my age.
Daniel Melchior, author of The Silk Finisher, thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street.
Yes, thank you for having me.
It's a great read.
Thank you.
After earning his BA and MBA degrees from the University of Southern Indiana, Dan Melchior moved to South Florida, where he served as an executive at several multinational corporations. In 2021, he earned an MA degree from Johns Hopkins University and is currently an administrator at San Diego State University. Here's a footnote to my interview with Dan Melchior. After the show, he attended a book signing and met up with Kelly Coors at Your Brother's Bookstore in downtown Evansville. Coors is the author of Out in Evansville, which includes a chapter on the Rudy Zemer case. And they pose for pictures, each holding each other's books. And it seems Dan Melchior's brother Sam was in Kelly Coors' graduating class at Harrison High School. Yes, it is a small world. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger, Kim Wren, and the Berger Wealth Services team at Bayard Private Wealth Management. 2 Main Street airs Thursday at noon and Saturday at 11. And previous shows are online at wnin.org.